Chapter 2, Singing My Life. June 1982. I don't remember the accident. I was a month shy of turning 2 years old, so I have to borrow the details of this memory from my mother. She was driving near our home in Fort Worth. It was just us and Dad's heap of a car, a 1964 Chevy Nova with a rust paint job. It was so old there were no seat belts in the back, and I would constantly shift across the cracked vinyl. I wanted to go to McDonald's, and my mom didn't seem to understand how serious I was about this. I stood on the back seat and leaned so I could throw my arms around her, grabbing her face with both hands to yell, "McDonald's!" "Jessica!" she screamed. She looked away from the road. How long? A second? Two? Enough to drive across the lane and hit a car coming towards us. I flew headfirst at the windshield. I went halfway through it, cracking my skull on the way. The drag of the glass held me, and I fell back inside the car, landing on the floorboard on the passenger side. The shattered windshield then fell on me in a shower of glass. Mom had a bone sticking out of her broken leg. She had also broken her arm and collarbone. She couldn't get out of the driver's side, so she climbed over me to pull herself out. Sitting on the ground, she brushed glass off of me, not sure if I was alive. A good Samaritan ran over to help us. An ambulance came and rushed us to the hospital. And thankfully, no one in the other car was injured. Someone at the hospital called my dad and told him his wife was in the hospital. "Your baby is in critical condition." I had two purple black eyes and a very bad concussion. My mom stayed in the hospital for a week. My stutter started soon after, and the doctor said it was from the head injury. My mom said that when I stuttered, it looked like my brain and I were trying to say 10 things at once. My voice just wouldn't work. "You can't focus on the one idea you need to talk about," she told me. "Just say the one thing, Jess." She is the youngest of three, the Drew girls of McGregor, Texas, and her middle sister Connie was a speech therapist. Aunt Connie advised her to get me to calm down. "Take a breath," my mother would say, getting down to my level to look me in the eye. That only worked so well. If you want someone to calm down, try telling them calm down and see where it gets you. But Connie had another idea, something that worked with other people who stuttered. Singing. "What you're trying to say," Mom said to me one day, "sing it to me." I turned the phrase over in my mind, smoothing the edges of its consonants and vowels until the words became the breaths of a song, a lyric I could control. "I want Cheerios," I sang. I can't describe that release, the rush of simply being understood. "Yes, you can have Cheerios," my mother yelled. "You can have whatever you want. You sound so beautiful." For the next 2 years, singing was the only time I didn't stutter. I sang for everything I wanted, like some Disney princess making a wish. Around four, the stutter became more pronounced, and my parents took me to a therapist. He used art therapy and asked me to draw myself in the family. I drew my parents standing in front of our house, then put myself inside looking out from a window. He told my parents I had a fear of abandonment. Looking back, I know my parents never left me alone, and maybe I was even around them too much. But somehow, I still had a fear that they would leave me. I kept going and the stutter resolved. I stayed shy, though, and it didn't really help that our family was constantly moving. We would move 18 times before I hit fifth grade. You move around a lot when you're working in the Baptist church, but my father was especially restless. Even when he left the ministry for a few years when I was little to see what it would be like for us to actually have money, he kept accepting transfers from his job selling postage meters for Pitney Bowes. He usually gave my mom and me 1 month's notice. Say bye to your friends, the ones I had just made. Even with my shyness, I learned to adjust until change was maybe not easy but expected. We were briefly living in Waco when my sister Ashley was born, October 1984. I was four and had prayed for a sister. I stopped every single person I saw in the hospital to bring them to the nursery. "That's my sister," I said over and over again. I didn't care if you were a nurse or doctor who had somewhere to be. You were going to see this baby girl. That night, I had a temper tantrum when Nana and Papaw, my mother's parents, said they were taking me to stay the night at their house. I didn't want Ashley to spend the night without me. She was my baby. When she came home, I kept putting a little pallet beneath her crib so I could sleep under her. When she was one and we were living in Littleton, Colorado, Ashley began to climb out of her crib and sneak into my room and sleep with me. Every morning, my mother would find us snuggled like two little puppies. We moved to Littleton in September 1985, the only time we left Texas during my childhood. I think my dad was escaping something. His father, my papa, had died suddenly in May of 1985, at age 64. He had been a beloved Southern Baptist preacher after serving as a U.S. Army sergeant in World War II. The nicest man on the planet. I just remember he had massive hands and this great big belly laugh. He always sat on a recliner, and I would tickle his feet just to hear him laugh. He died while my parents were on a trip to Hawaii that they had saved up for and probably still couldn't afford. They left me with my mom's parents and Ashley with Dad's. Papa showed up 2 hours early to get Ashley the morning of the trip, and the change of plans infuriated my dad. He didn't feel like entertaining his father. "I've got stuff to do," he yelled at Papa. They got on the plane, and he never saw Papa again. He died of a heart attack while they were in Hawaii. 1 minute, he was mowing the lawn. The next, he was gone. After that, my dad felt lost. We moved to Colorado and didn't even go to church. The irony is that my dad got a job selling to churches supplies like choir robes and stained glass. I thought he sold BMWs because he drove one and it was all he talked about. Littleton was magic to a Texas girl, so opposite of what I knew. I had only seen snow in picture books about Santa Claus, so there was magic to it. We moved just before I started kindergarten, and I liked school, even if the day sort of peaked with the Pledge of Allegiance. I loved hearing our voices in unison with our hands on our hearts, making this solemn vow that felt important. I was just never going to be the best student because I didn't know yet that I was a different kind of learner. It was hard for me to focus in school. And as the teacher talked, my mind wouldn't just wander off. It would take off running like a track star. By the time I realized I wasn't listening, I had accidentally given my mind such a head start that I could never catch up. But if we went on a field trip, I could tell you all about where we went and what we learned. I told myself I was more of a life experience type, and I would rather travel to the place we were talking about and form my own opinion than be told what was important. The morning of January 28, 1986, we kindergartners sat on the floor, crisscross applesauce, to watch the Challenger space shuttle launch. Our class had spent a couple weeks learning about space and planets in preparation, because our school was one of the many in America that NASA TV had hooked up with a live viewing of the launch. NASA made a big deal about that flight because it was the first time a normal non-astronaut was going into space. Krista McAuliffe, a social studies teacher from Concord, New Hampshire, was picked from thousands of applicants in NASA's Teacher in Space project. We were all excited because when else did we get to watch TV in school? At 9:38 a.m., we watched as the Challenger blew up in a ball of white smoke. At first, we thought it was the blast-off moment. I think even our teachers did. And then there was just nothing in the air. The teacher turned off the TV, but it was too late. A room full of five-year-olds had just watched seven people die, and there was no hiding that fact. There they were, and then they were gone. Let's just say we had some questions. When I got home, my parents let me watch President Ronald Reagan speak to the nation from the Oval Office at 3 o'clock our time. I didn't understand much of the speech, but I listened when it felt like he talked directly to me. And I want to say something to the school children of America who are watching the live coverage of the shuttle's takeoff, he said. I know it is hard to understand, but sometimes painful things like this happen. It's all a part of the process of exploration and discovery. It's all part of taking a chance and expanding man's horizons. The future doesn't belong to the faint-hearted. It belongs to the brave. The future belonged to the brave. When I went to bed, I prayed for all the astronauts, for Krista McAuliffe and her family. President Reagan had talked about their sacrifice, and in my 5-year-old mind, I decided the best way to honor that was to take on Krista McAuliffe's work and become an astronaut and teacher. Krista McAuliffe needed me to do it, and kids like me who had trouble following along in class needed a teacher who understood the way they learned. I was so serious about becoming an astronaut after this tragedy that my parents let me attend space camp that summer. I was all in. They gave each of us a little NASA blue button-down shirt, so I was basically already an astronaut in my mind. They led us into the zero-gravity simulator built to look like you were in a shuttle, and I took right to floating around, flying through the air just like I did in my dreams. And then I hit the first roadblock on the race to space. Lunch. They served freeze-dried ice cream as a treat. "This is what they eat in space," one of the counselors said, cheerily passing out the foil-wrapped squares, each with chemical stripes of strawberry, vanilla, and chocolate. One small bite of that chalky excuse for dessert felt like a betrayal. "Ugh," I said, spitting it into a napkin. "I can't be an astronaut, no way." I hung up my NASA dreams right then and there. By the end of the summer, things were tense at home. My parents were fighting a lot, each accusing the other of overspending. They always stayed kind to each other in front of Ashley and me, but sometimes one would have to storm off to keep from saying something nasty. This made me think about money from a young age, even though we had never had any, so I didn't know any different. Before I was born, Dad took out a $2,000 loan from the one bank in Cross Plains, Texas, and had them keep the money because he knew Mom and he couldn't help but blow through it. Then that money went to pay the hospital when I was born. My dad paid the doctor who delivered me with the Canon 24-70mm lens on his camera. Dr. McDonald admired it as Dad photographed my arrival. "I tell you what, Dr. McDonald, I will trade you this lens for your bill." More and more I heard them fight, and my dad saying, "We'll fly by this month, we'll be fine." I wanted to help but didn't know how until the answer came to me at where else but the mall. I remember walking by some kiosk that had these ornaments with everybody's name and its meaning. I saw mine and held it on the hook. Jessica, the wealthy one. It stayed with me. I walked around thinking, "I'm the wealthy one." Not realizing it meant rich in spirit. I just thought it was about money, and every time my parents seemed to worry, I said, "I'm going to be rich." I'd be the one to lift my parents out of their struggles. I'd be the one to end their fights once and for all. "Well, God provides," my dad said. "He'll always provide for you." But we needed money now. There was no secret fortune for me to find and no cute barter stories about camera lenses to be had. My family declared bankruptcy to get out from under the weight of the bills. As part of what my mom called a reorganization, my parents announced we were moving back to Texas. Dad called around and got a job as a youth minister in Burleson, a little town in the Fort Worth area. So it was time to say goodbye to my friends again. Soon after we moved, I started first grade. I walked into a room full of strangers who all seemed to know each other, and I did my best to fade into the background. I was relieved my seat was in the back, and I chose to sit in the back whenever I could at school. We lived in a 2-bedroom apartment, which my mom hated because she had gotten used to living in a 5-bedroom house in Littleton. We weren't there much because our life revolved around church. When my dad returned to preaching, I thought we moved because God would tell my dad it was time to move. He studied to be an adolescent therapist, learning how to reach that brain. Because he was such a good storyteller, he could tug at the heart, too. He made people weep, holding up their hands as they listened to him share the word in a way they had never heard. Even as a kid, I could feel the energy of change in the room when my dad was working. And I changed also. In the Baptist faith, you choose to be baptized when you're ready. It's for believers only. It's up to you. You don't just baptize an infant and make the decision for them, which is kind of cool because for a religion that can be painted as so confining, individual choice is a fundamental part of being Baptist. On a Sunday that had felt very normal up until that moment, I felt the word, and I made the choice. My dad was up front preaching, and he asked if anybody wanted to come down to be baptized in the name of Christ. I stood up in my white dress, hugged my mother, and stepped forward. As I approached, my father began to cry. He helped me into the baptismal pool, and I felt his hand on my back as he gently submerged me. The water washed over me, and I emerged new. Growing up, there would be kids who would get baptized a lot. I always kind of rolled my eyes at that because a lot of them did it for attention. It's not a car wash, you know? The one time took for me. Dad's youth minister salary was about $25,000 a year, so my mom was always looking for ways to supplement the income. This was the era of Jazzercise, and she saw that Jane Fonda's workout was becoming the highest-selling VHS tape of all time. She thought, I can do that. Since we're always at church, she decided to start teaching an aerobics class there. She had to talk in front of the whole deacon board to get approval, and she brought us along. There was this old country man who kept staring at her as she talked about aerobics. He finally interrupted her. You're going to be doing acrobatics in the church chapel? Aerobics, she said, over-enunciating every syllable. Working out, good for your heart. The men looked at each other. It was bad enough my dad had an earring, and now his crazy wife wanted people dancing in the church. Finally, she hit on the point. I'm going to be helping women get their best bodies possible. Again, the men looked at each other, but this time they were sold. She started the Heavenly Bodies Company, and the class was called Jump for Jesus. No, I will not shut my mouth. This is really what she called it. Let's continue. Jump for Jesus was popular, and I went to almost every class, collecting all the checks made out to Heavenly Bodies. I sat in the back with all these women jamming to Michael W. Smith and Amy Grant, the cool Christian singers at the time. Stretch your arms towards the heavens, my mother would yell. Lift those knees higher for Jesus. Mom made her own workout video, which I also sold. If we went to any Baptist conferences, you bet we brought those tapes along. Laugh, but she got what she wanted. We left the apartment and leased a two-story house as we continued to make payments on our debts. They still overspent, but not on extravagant things. They just wanted to be the parents who said yes when their daughters asked for caboodles for Christmas. We opened a lot of credit cards and thanked God for layaway. It was a part of their relentless positivity. They were in the business of changing lives. Mom and Dad were always taking people in. When parents threw their pregnant daughter out, she needed a place to sleep until they came to their senses. When a kid was trying not to do drugs, he needed to get away from parents who had their own issues with addiction. In the South, there were so many secrets, and my parents were there to give people a safe place. Even when my parents didn't physically take people in, they collected people to look after. One day after Jump for Jesus, my mom took me across the street to a young woman's house. I will call her Jane to protect her privacy. Jane was probably 19, a heavyset girl with brown hair who had run away from Iowa to follow some dumb boy who liked her because she wasn't used to that. He got her pregnant and skipped town before the baby boy arrived. She was stranded in Burleson, broke with no support, and her parents thought she had made her bed so she could just stay there. This was before anybody understood postpartum depression, when it was just women who could recognize it in each other and step in to say, let me help you. But Jane had nobody. That's why my mom had a heart for her. So when she hadn't seen her for a bit, she was concerned. She called the house from the church and there was no answer. Come on, Jess, she said. Let's just check on her. You could hear the baby crying before you even got to the door, wailing. Mom knocked and there was no answer. Jane, she called. She looked at me for 1 second, and some mom instinct in her kicked in. The door was unlocked, so she let herself in. Jane, it's Tina, she called out as she made her way to the room with the crib. There was no answer. The baby was left all alone in the house. He was on a plastic sheet, not even a real sheet, and he was covered in pee and poop. When Mom went to lift him, she realized he was literally stuck to the bed. Jess, go sit in the living room, she said. I did as I was told as my mom ran to the bathroom and took every towel and washcloth she could find to run under warm water. She brought them to the crib and used the warm, wet towels to unstick the poor baby. She lovingly cleaned him as we both cried. She went to the kitchen and made a bottle of formula just from the muscle memory of motherhood. You're okay, she whispered to him again and again as he took hungry gulps. You're okay. When he was finally calm, she held him in the crook of her arm and went to the phone on the wall. Joe, I'm at Jane's, she said. I'm bringing this baby home. She left a note for Jane saying the baby was safe and asked her to come to our house. When she showed up, my parents didn't judge her. My parents were always good like that. They were just doing the best they could, too. Jane wasn't a bad person. She just needed help with her depression. She would not be equipped to parent until she could take care of herself. If she had a family, my mother explained to her, they would see how she was struggling and step in. Jane didn't have that, but she had us. That's the power of faith in action. It's not about talking and judging. It's about doing. Jane's baby lived with us for 6 weeks, and I thought I had a new baby brother. I know my parents were prepared to formally adopt him if need be. As we cared for the baby, my father got Jane into therapy, and my parents helped her reconcile with her family. Soon, she was able to take the baby back to Iowa with her. My mother tried to make it a joyous thing for us. Jane was going home to be reunited with her parents. The baby is going to be where he needs to be, she said. I felt a real loss, though. As I remember it, she just up and vanished with the baby, which of course isn't true. But tell it to a six-year-old. I loved him. The way he slept with his hands up, totally at peace as a little boy in Ashley's hand-me-downs. The first morning after he left with Jane, I briefly forgot he was gone, and I felt that all-body disappointment that kids experience. Your shoulders sink with your heart, and you think you'll never get over it. I did. I had to. With the same fervor that my mom now flips houses, my parents fixed people throughout my childhood. We took in people who were sick or neglected, and it wasn't always fun. Sometimes it was a chore to share my parents with others. Our family time was always with others, whether they were there physically or talked about in our prayers. To whom much is given, much is expected, was what I heard. I understood, but sometimes I didn't feel we had much to share. No matter where we moved, Nana and Papaw's house in McGregor was home base. The five of us cousins, the children of the Drew girls, my mom and her two older sisters would play outside from the second my parents pulled into the driveway. The oldest were Debbie's kids, Zeb and his younger sister Sarah, then Connie's son Drew, then me and Ashley bringing up the rear. At 6 years old, I was exactly 2 years and 3 days younger than Sarah, who I idolized as more of a big sister and best friend than a cousin. Sarah was already so effortlessly cool that I loved everything she loved. She liked pigs, so I liked pigs. When her family visited us in Colorado, we made snow pigs instead of snow angels. She went horseback riding, and, well, I tried. Now that we were back in Texas, we made the hour-and-a-half drive to McGregor all the time. McGregor is a small town next to Waco, the buckle of the Bible Belt. My grandparents lived on Leafy Hollow, named for all the tall, skinny trees that reached so high to the sky. The trees created clouds of white flowers in the spring and a canopy of green throughout the summer. There were at least a dozen in the front yard alone. We cousins played in the creek behind their house, and all of us wore our McGregor's Bulldogs t-shirts. Even Ashley, about to turn two, danced around in her size small t-shirt, swirling in it like a princess dress. This was a tribute to Papaw, who was the beloved line and strength coach at McGregor High. AC Drew was ace to everyone when he made first team All-State as a quarterback in high school, then played football for Baylor. But by the time I came along, everyone in town called him coach, stepped aside for him when he passed, and never once thought about cussing in his presence for fear of what he would do. Believe everything you've heard about the reverence for football in Texas. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Hail Mary pass. He'd been a tough man, but he softened with age. Men don't normally change, I know, but they can. I like it when they do. The only thing he loved more than his Lord and Savior Jesus Christ was us kids, and he would casually patrol the creek while we were out there, keeping watch for snakes. If he spotted one, he'd pick it up and squeeze its neck, even the rattlesnakes. My Nana, Dorothy Jane, was my prayer warrior. She held firm to her Christian faith and did all things through He who strengthened her. Her steadfastness was almost a response to her mother. Bertha D. died a couple weeks after I was born, but she was a legend to me. She was a full-blooded Indian, I grew up hearing in whispers from my cousins and my mother. My great-grandmother read people's fortunes and aligned her gardens with the stars. This was always said before a long dramatic pause. Nana never wanted to talk about her. If I said anything about astrology or being a Cancer, my grandmother would go move quick to hush me. I heard different stories about my great-grandmother. Cautionary tales about what could happen if you leaned in hard on that intuition. I don't know the full story, but I know that she was a card reader in Waco, Texas, at a time when that was not done. She was considered crazy by a lot of people in town. That buckle on the Bible belt can come down hard and leave a mark. But I'd stare into the mirror at my brown eyes and high cheekbones, convinced I was Native American. More than that, we Simpson girls, my mother included, all seemed a little witchy. A nicer word would be intuitive. We had a good sense of people from the get-go, and we often knew what was going to happen before it happened. Sometimes we chalked it up to our faith that God would provide, sometimes to just paying attention. But often it felt like we knew what was destined to be. Everything that happened in my life just felt preordained. Still does. If we weren't at Nana and Papaw's, the family usually met up at my cousin Sarah's house. Her dad, Uncle Boyd, put up a tire swing while I was in Colorado, and when I got back, it was all me and Sarah wanted to do. She loved the swing. And like I said, I loved everything she loved. Aunt Debbie, Sarah's mom, was even more of a devout Christian than my parents, and while Sarah and I ran outside, she would listen to one of her evangelist tapes. Sermons all the time, loud, so everybody could hear. You'd dip in and out of a deep, solemn voice rolling across the yard as we played. Now I want you to turn with me to 2 Chronicles of the 33rd chapter. It was spring, and I sat on the grass as Sarah swung in the twilight air. I watched the long curls of her brown hair trail behind her like a comet. It was just us. And I wanted to tell her something, because I could always talk to her about anything. But this time I stayed quiet. Something had happened, twice now, and I was supposed to keep it secret. The daughter of a family friend was abusing me when my parents brought us for overnight stays. It started the winter I was six, when I shared a bed with the girl. She was a year older than me. After lights out, I would feel her hands on me. It would start with tickling my back and then going into things that were extremely uncomfortable. Freezing became my defense mechanism. And to this day, when I panic, I freeze. We had an earthquake recently here in LA, and instead of running for cover, I grabbed a bag of Cheetos and just stood there eating them. The second time she abused me, it was during a spring visit, and Ashley also shared the bed. I lay between them, fiercely protecting my sister from this monster. I didn't want her to feel as disgusting as I felt. For 6 years, I was abused by this girl during our family visits, which happened 3 times a year. Eventually, it wasn't just nighttime. She would get me to go into a closet with her or just find a way to linger until we were alone. It got to the point that she would sneak into the bathroom to watch me shower. I did not know how to get away from her. She continued to try to sleep next to my little sister, and I would just scooch Ashley over and get in between them whenever she did. I never let her near Ashley, but I also never screamed or told her to stop. I was confused, wondering if it was something that I wanted to keep going. Why am I not telling anybody? I asked myself. Is it because it feels good? The irony is that I was protecting my abuser. I thought that if I named what she was doing, she would feel the shame I felt, and I wouldn't have wished that on anybody. I never slept well again. Well, I could sleep, but it took forever to get there. Even at home in my own bed, there was a feeling that I had to stay up to keep watch. I stopped waiting for Ashley to come to my room and started sleeping in her bed. I remember the humiliation of saying to my baby sister, 4 years younger than me, "Ashley, can I share your room?" Even then, I would lie awake waiting for my brain to shut off. I wanted to keep us both safe, but I also wanted protection too. Ashley was already becoming her own person. She always took good care of looking after herself, and I was terrified someone could take that courage from her. Over the years of this family friend abusing me, I learned that she was being molested by an older boy. I can't play armchair psychiatrist and guess what her motives were for abusing me, but I can feel her pain and mine at the same time. She would describe her experiences in detail, and it was all so crazy because I was so young and I didn't know anything about sex or about my private parts. My parents never talked to me about this. I mean, they taught me my body was a temple of God, but that was in reference to some imaginary guy in the future. It was never about someone who's supposed to be a friend making you do things you don't want to do. So I came to understand sex and my body solely in terms of power, or in this case, lack of power. I was just going to let her do whatever it was she wanted to do because I didn't want to hurt her feelings. That's kind of how I was in many of my adult relationships, too. At first, I held myself back, refusing to have sex until I was married. I was afraid sex and the need I had to give pleasure no matter what would destroy me as I let men walk all over me. I was right, but I'm getting ahead of myself. I only found the strength to tell my parents what was happening because I made a deal with God. I was 12, and my family was in the car on the way out of town where the girl lived. It was a 4-hour car ride, and my father would always stop at the gas station to fill up the car and buy 2 scratch-off lottery tickets, one for me and Ashley. I won so often that it was like a family joke. The wealthy one, at it again. And I always thought it was God looking out for me. My dad handed each of us a ticket and a quarter when he got back in the car. Usually I scratched the ticket right away, but this time I stalled. First, I wanted to tell my parents what was happening to me. What had just happened again the night before. For me, this would be a confession, because I felt like I might be sinning by allowing her to continue to do these things to me. I was the victim, but somehow I felt in the wrong. I waited until we were on the road when Ashley would put her headphones on. She was 8, and I wanted to protect her from hearing what I had to say. But when she did put them on, I lost my nerve and decided not to say anything. I rested my head against the window to feel the rhythm of the Texas road. Occasionally, I lifted my head ready to speak, and then I didn't. It was like back when I stuttered. The words just wouldn't come. I rubbed the quarter between my thumb and pointer finger. "In God we trust," it read. God and I were always in conversation. No matter what I did in life, he was there. If I do this, my reward will be in this ticket, I thought. He'll give me a prize for being honest. I started with a quiet sing-song of, guys, like I was tuning an instrument. My parents didn't hear me. I cleared my throat, and the words spilled out in a quiet rush. I feel like you guys might know that this has been going on, I said. But if you don't know what's been going on, she's been touching me for years and it makes me really uncomfortable and I don't ever want to go back there. I couldn't undo it. It was done. My mother slapped my father's arm with the back of her hand. I told you something was happening, she yelled at him. Neither turned to look at me. Dad kept his eye on the road and said nothing, his shoulders sunken. It didn't surprise me that my mother knew. I already understood denial and how much it fueled the actions of families, especially Southern families. People want to paint the picture pretty, especially a minister's family. They were probably also shocked. These good people who did everything to help others hadn't been able to help their own daughter. Hello, I said. I expected them to say something to me. I wasn't angry, I was just confused. I wouldn't be angry about their silence until much later. I scratched off the ticket, knowing I would win something. It was $1,500. I looked up to God. Then I brushed the ticket against my mother's shoulder, forcing her to look back at me. She took the ticket and screamed to my father. $1,500? She said, drawing out the words. Dad pulled over and Ashley pulled off her headphones in confusion. They told her, so excited, and she looked at me with her eyes wide. She gave me a huge smile and I took it so I could manage to give it back to her. Dad did a U-turn to take us back to the gas station so we could collect our winnings. My parents clung to the happiness of that ticket, thrilled to be rescued with a change in subject. We never stayed at my parents' friend's house again, but we also didn't talk about what I had said. Instead, we just went back to start, as if what I said happened to me happened to some other girl, in some other car, in some other life.